The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards with another edition of the Armchair Traveler from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Over the next half hour, I will be reading to you from National Geographic Traveler and the Washington Post. Before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you, neither the Triangle Radio Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles we will be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. On today's Armchair Traveler, we're going to begin with a quest. This is a regular column found in National Geographic Traveler. And in the June-July 2018 issue, writer Adrian Phillips wrote about her quest, Amsterdam. Now undergoing a Dutch revival, the editors state that once polluted, Amsterdam's canals now welcome back fish, herons, swimmers, and the very curious canal lobster. Let's learn more. You can't really claim to know a city until you've had a discussion about its sewage with an aquatic ecologist from the local water board. I hadn't given much thought to what goes on below Amsterdam before I met Laura Moria in a coffee shop near the Anne Frank House. Moria spends her life scrutinizing the Dutch capital's canals, scooping and testing and doing whatever aquatic ecologists do to keep tabs on microscopic nasties. Until recently, it was a job that required a strong stomach. The canals used to stink, she tells me. They contained untreated sewage, and if you fell in, you'd be rushed off to the hospital for a tetanus shot. But the past decade has witnessed a concerted push to clean things up. Thousands of houseboats have finally been linked to the sewer system, and a special vessel patrols the channels with a net to skim off floating rubbish. There's even a boat dedicated to hauling out the 15,000 odd bikes that are chucked in the water annually. The results have been dramatic, so dramatic, in fact, that around 3,000 people jump into the canals of their own accord during the Amsterdam City Swim each September. Even our queen has taken a dip, Maria says. The flora and fauna are also flourishing in the purer water. Yellow water lilies flower in summer in quieter areas, while water fleas zip about eating algae or now are in turn gobbled up by fish that had previously given the canals a wide berth. Pike, eel, and carp have all returned, along with the herons that stalk them and coots that dabble among the reeds. There are bullhead fish, mussels, and Maria's favorite, a snail with a head like a smurf. It's a smorgasbord of life. Our tap water is filtered through the sand dunes. You must try it, she urges as she pays for her cappuccino. Oh, and look out for canal lobster on the menu, she adds cryptically over her shoulder before the door closes and she's gone. Canal lobster? While there's a limit to how exciting I can find the prospect of a good glass of tap water, the mysterious canal lobster sounds like something altogether more enticing. I vow to track one down, but first, a canal boat tour. If there are newfound riches hidden below the water's surface, those above have been plain to see for centuries. Amsterdam is a city built on water, both literally and metaphorically, the horseshoe of canals at its heart constructed during a period when the Dutch ruled the waves, and this was the world's greatest port. Aboard the Tourist, a 41-foot salon boat with polished teak flooring, our skipper, Ono Basilar, noses us through a low-slung bridge separating the grandly titled Emperor's Canal, Keizersgracht, from the more blue-collar Brewer's Canal, or Brouwersgracht. Reminders of the city's ocean-going history are everywhere. We pass the monumental sweep of Amsterdam Central Station, a wind dial on its tower to assist sailors, and the Basilica of St. Nicholas, dedicated to the patron saint of seafarers. The waterway widens, and we round the green hull of the Nemo Science Museum, designed by Renzo Piano. To look like the prow of a hulking ship and then a full-size replica of the Amsterdam, a Dutch East India Company cargo ship, a sign we've reached the jetty of the Maritime Museum. The Dutch East India Company is synonymous with the country's golden age. Founded in 1602, it was the first multinational, making gargantuan profits importing spices from the Far East. Amsterdam grew into the warehouse of the world, handling everything from timber and wine to porcelain. The 17th century was a very good time to be a Dutch merchant, and their lavish mansions are strung along the most exclusive stretch of canal. Herrengrat, merchants' houses with gables like elaborate headdresses face each other across the water as if waiting for the orchestra to kickstart a masquerade dance. And the so-called Golden Bend boasts the grandest residences of all, with their double-width plots available only to those with pockets as deep as ditches. "The fronts are nothing," Basilar comments as we drift past. "You should see inside." Museum von Loon at Kaisergrat 672 offers the chance to do just that. The von Loon family made its money in herring, Tonko Grever, the museum's former director, tells me. I glance around the carnivorous entrance hall with a new respect for sardines. This was a powerful dynasty. William von Loon became mayor of Amsterdam, and his son oversaw the East India Company for 30 years. We walk through reception room after reception room, up a sweeping staircase to bedroom after bedroom, out into gardens with manicured hedges, a golden sundial, and a brick-floored coach house flanked by classical statues. There are cherry wood chests, four-poster beds, and stuffed peacock on a mantelpiece, and everywhere, large portraits of von Loons in ermine or pearls, for Amsterdam's merchants loved commissioning paintings of themselves. Rembrandt's paintings weren't for museums, Grever reminds me. They were hung in private houses like this. But for all the bounty earned on the high seas, Amsterdam's elite found the water can be foe as well as friend. Canal houses stand on wooden foundations, piles driven deep into the mud, and when the water drops, the piles rot. This is why some houses are oddly lopsided, leaning against neighbors like walking wounded, their foundations subsiding beneath them. I dined that night at De Silveren Spiegel, the Silver Mirror restaurant. Though it's not on the canal, the 1614 building tilts drunkenly with floors that sag like washing lines. I ask my waiter if the restaurant offers canal lobster. No, he says, carefully, as if humoring a madman. If that's a thing, the kitchen of the unwanted animal might sell it. They'll be at Rolling Kitchens. This 5-day food festival is taking place in a cultural park northwest of the center. I've barely time to be heartened by the banner above the entrance, which shows a plump lobster on wheels, before I'm enveloped by noise, smell, and color. Scores of open-sided trucks are serving food, cooked on little stoves or on coal-fired grills, while musicians bang drums or strum guitars. Every corner of the globe is covered. There's Indian cuisine at the Bali Foods van, slogan, "Get curried away," ooh, and Vietnamese street food at Nam Nam. Just say, cheese, sweet dreams are made of cheese, who am I to disagree? Offers cheeseburgers, and everything on a stick is exactly like that. Even with all the weird and wonderful foods around it, puns included, the kitchen of the unwanted animal still swivels heads. Where else can you wash My Little Pony burger down with a glass of Japanese knotweed juice? Its origins are as unorthodox as its menu. I'm a conceptual artist, not a cook, says founder Rob Hagenau, handing me a goose croquette. My kitchen was meant as a statement. Hagenau is pained by society's prolificacy on the discovering that geese shot at Schiphol Airport to cut the risk of bird strikes were simply thrown away. He decided to highlight the waste by creating something tasty from these unwanted animals, hence his croquette, which is creamy inside with a spicy coating. And canal lobster, I ask? I don't have any here, says Hagenau. Your best bet might be Restaurant A's. Well, thwarted again, but undeterred, I make a dinner reservation, and that evening, there it is at last. Pinky red against the bucket, pinchers raised at me with justified mistrust. This is one of the several caught last night for Restaurant As by Rick Khrushchev, who brought it to the table for me to see it before it's dispatched to the pot with the others. A canal lobster, or more properly, a red swamp crayfish, an invasive species originally from the U.S. that's flourishing in the clean water of the canals. I feel a pang of sympathy for the condemned as the crayfish eyes me from his container, but the pang quickly disappears when I reach out to pick him up and he clamps his claws on my finger. Kreshevik explains there's no place here for sentimentality. Red crayfish eat fish eggs, they kill the native European crayfish, and they dig holes in the dikes. It's our duty to eat them. So when Chef Luc Langendijk brings me a starter of crayfish tails with an herb mustard dip, I grab a fork and do my duty. Then I do it again by consuming a main course of crayfish bouillon. The meat is sweet and quite delicious. As the plates are cleared, I ponder how many other people can claim to have been bitten by their own dinner. For all the canal lobster's allure, I decide the Van Loons had it right. It's safer to stick to herring. Well, accompanying the article here, we have Amsterdam's shipping news, some tips about the Amsterdam area. Throughout Amsterdam, the once opulent symbols of the city's maritime wealth have been repurposed. The Grand Hotel Amrath Amsterdam, originally built in 1912 as the headquarters for a number of the city's shipping companies, drips with symbols of the Golden Age, from the world map in its stained glass roof to the billowing sails in its mahogany panels. But the shipping company shipped out long ago. Their office is now given over to guest rooms. Then there's NDSM Wharf, the city's biggest shipyard before it went bankrupt in the 1980s. It's now a gritty hub of contemporary art. The industrial wasteland behind Amsterdam's central train station has been transformed by the space-age architecture of the iFilm Institute Netherlands, while the oil refinery tower next door reopened as the Adam Torin, its focus on cutting-edge music. Perhaps this is the new golden age, a waterfront renaissance driven by culture and food, an age of experiment and urban expression, whose eddies and swirls will surface their very own Dutch masters. Well, that's quite an interesting treat, huh? By the way, writer Adrian Phillips is managing director of Brat Tribal Guides, so there's some more information for you. And speaking of traveling, have you ever felt your travels might be going to the dogs? Well, the editors of National Geographic Traveler want to help. In their June-July 2018 issue, they provide their best list column, 21 Dog Destinations. As they state, good news for travelers and their BFFs, that's best furry friends, more places than ever are catering to canines. Let's find out more. Go, dog, go, to beaches, resorts, and almost anywhere else people go. With roughly 60 million pup-filled households in the U.S., travel is going to the dogs. Once the exception, pet-friendly policies are gaining traction across North America. Here are a few of our favorite spots to visit with Fido. First up is the Dog Day Beaches. Northwest Oregon's Cannon Beach regularly earns best-in-show accolades. Dog-loving restaurants dot downtown, and pups that are leashed or especially obedient can splash in the surf. Paddle with your pooch in the Gulf of Mexico, a southwest Florida's off-leash dog beach located south of Lover's Key State Recreation Area. Buy a dog-friendly area permit, $10, for Montrose Dog Beach, Chicago's first official off-leash beach. How about some possum paths? Well, Colorado's Golden State Canyon Park has 35-plus miles of trails open to leash dogs. Hike the Raccoon Trail to see the Continental Divide and snap high-altitude selfies at Panorama Point Scenic Overlook. Conquer New England's highest peak, New Hampshire's 6,288-foot Mount Washington via the 4.5-mile one-way Amonasuck Ravine Trail. This route has natural water bowls, streams, a lake, and is easier on paws than rockier summit trails. At Quebec's Park Adventures Cap Jussieu, dogs bunk with owners in cabins or tents and stroll with views on the Saguenay Fjord, one of the world's longest. Then we have some tasty bites. In San Francisco, you can chow down at more than 170 dog-friendly restaurants. French Bistro Zazzy, near Golden Gate Park's Dog Play Area 1, welcomes canines to its patio, and Monday nights offers $10 off bottles of wine to patrons with pups. Yard Bar in Austin, Texas, features an off-leash dog park where adults sip beverages, try the Rescue Me, vodka, lime juice, mint, and ginger beer, while pooches play. Outdoors at Sally's Fish House and Bar, pups can watch boats and birds in San Diego Bay while devouring dog menu dishes like frozen pulpsicles made from bananas, peanut butter, and yogurt. How about some sit and stay? Well, Doggy Dream Destination Barkwells in Mills River, North Carolina, has 8 ritzy cabins with dog doors and private yards, fenced meadows, and a pond. 2017, Canopy by Hilton rolled out its North American Paws in the Neighborhood program at the Wharf in Washington, D.C. Tail-wagging perks like dog beds and dog-friendly resources, guides Help pets up to 75 pounds feel at home. Four-legged directors of pet relations lend a paw at the Climpton Hotels, the big dog of pet-friendly stays, no weight limit or fees, pampered pooch amenities such as dog menu room service and pedicures vary by location. Then we have some bark parks. Hugh Rogers Wag Park in Whitefish, Montana is a five-acre playground complete with agility course, pond, dog wash, and covered pavilion. Drive to Sweet Peaks for lactose-free dog pops or chicken or beef-flavored dog ice cream. Seattle's Mangosan Park is home to the city's biggest 8.6 acres off-leash area and the only one with access to Lake Washington. If your pup can handle watching, not chasing, balls, catch a game together at a Major League South ballpark. Several teams such as the Kansas City Royals, New York Mets, and Pittsburgh Pirates host Dog Day promotions. Then we have some luxury digs. In Virginia, Horse Country, Salamander Resort and Spa rolls out the green turf carpet for VIPs, very important pooches, and provides perks like biscuits made by the pastry chef. Pups get the royal treatment at Quebec's Fairmont La Manne Richelieu, whose June 2018 guests include Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, Dad DeKenzie, and other G7 summit attendees. At Napa Valley's Calistoga Ranch, dogs sniff out bacon on vineyard scavenger hunts and slurp bone broth martinis. Pets go glam at the Peninsula, New York, the opulent Fifth Avenue Hotel located a short, fashionable stroll from Central Park. Oh, my, the things you get to do when you're a dog. Whew. Oh, well. Well, let's leave Fido at the spa and address obsessions. Another regular column found in National Geographic Traveler, and this one in the June-July 2018 issue, writer Daniel Stone discussing his obsession with food origins. His essay talks about America's fruit recruiter. Love avocado toast? Daniel says you can thank a wandering 19th century food spy. There was a man yelling excitedly, and I realized he was yelling at me. To walk the rows at the Davis Farmers Market in California's Central Valley is to come face to face with some of the highest quality fruit on the planet and the experts who grow it. I was 18 in college, and this man, a farmer named Steve, was demanding I try his peaches. About a year later, my roommate delicately observed that I might be addicted to fruit. I'd regularly come home from Steve's farm with dozens of pounds of peaches, cherries, and apples. I'd pick, prune, and chase birds away, and I was paid in fructose. He offered me a full-time job with the promise to drive a truck and hawk fruit at Northern California's farmers markets. Plus, it was implied, all the fruit I could eat, but I turned him down. I wanted to be a news reporter for a year, and I told him I'd be right back. So it was rather predictable that I'd eventually come across David Fairchild, a man who had successfully made fruit his job. I read in an old book that Fairchild, a late 19th century food spy, traveled the world to find exotic crops that didn't exist in the U.S. He was the man who brought America its first official avocados, kale, and mangoes, and he helped to procure the famous cherry blossom trees in Washington, D.C. At gatherings, I'd rattle off Fairchild's greatest hits, and almost every time a friend would say, "Gosh, it never dawned on me that someone brought those things here." For 3 years, I followed Fairchild's unprecedented travels. I combed his botanical memos, his diaries, his travel manifest. I visited his grandchildren in Nova Scotia, who showed me a file folder marked personal. "We don't think it'd be appropriate to share these letters," one of the granddaughters said, but eventually they did, and I sat up all night reading the century-old love letters of a man who probably never would have written them if he knew a stranger would put them in a book. People of the 19th century rarely left their hometown, let alone traveled around the country. Fairchild traveled farther than most people alive ever had. One of the first places he went was Java, clear across the world, to see the teeming palms and strange fruits of the tropics. He sailed to Fiji, the so-called Cannibal Islands, and drank mouth-numbing kava with men who had eaten human flesh. In Chile, he picked up a peculiar fruit known as an alligator pear, its insides green and smooth. More than a century later, the alligator pear is now simply the avocado, a fruit with its own fan club and hipster store in Brooklyn. Fairchild's life was one of unimaginable adventure. He bargained for plants with Egyptian royalty and charmed Bavarian hops growers, a normally suspicious bunch who posted guards to protect their fields. He witnessed death, outran diseases, and got arrested for espionage. In all, he traveled to more than 50 countries, all over land or by boat. Along the way, he picked up luxury cotton in Egypt, tiny pineapples in South America, watermelons in Argentina, and cashew trees in the Middle East. After each tour, he'd make his way back to American shores on a slow and creaky steamship, hoping the entire way that he'd arrive before the seeds or cuttings dried out. Often, while I'm writing a news article or reading a book, I stare out the window and wonder how my life would be different if I were a bit more like Fairchild. Instead of writing about fruit, I was growing it and making novel fruits such as mangosteens, durians, and dragon fruit more accessible to more people. Steve, my farmer friend, calls sometimes to say the job is still open, that he's still got a truck idling for me. Well, last summer, I went to spend a couple of days on the farm, my annual pilgrimage to get some dirt under my fingernails. Before I left, Steve asked if it's just this once I could haul about 800 pounds of peaches a few hundred miles to a market. We loaded up my car and I set off, even as my little Mazda shook with exhaustion. I just smiled, chucking pits out the window the whole way. Oh, my. Well, he has a little bit of a side here called Where's Your Fruit From? And writes, surprisingly few of the foods we eat are native to North America. Most foods arrived in the U.S. in the knapsacks or steamer trunks of 19th and 20th century travelers. Florida oranges came from China. Amber waves of wheat immigrated from Russia. Washington apples are from Kazakhstan. And many Napa Valley grapes are native to Eastern Europe. Bananas are the single most sold item at Walmart, but they're from about as far from the U.S. coast, where they were first introduced, as something can be, Southeast Asia. Sunflowers are one of the few truly American crops grown for their seed, oil, and the bright blooms and bouquets every spring. So if you love gardens and fruits, there's some information that could be quite helpful. And by the way, the writer Daniel Stone is the author of The Food Explorer, The True Adventures of the Globetrotting Botanists Who Transform What America Eats. And Daniel also is an editor and writer for National Geographic magazine. Now to the West Coast, where in San Francisco, visitors and locals ride the rails as they did a century ago. Our writer guide is Justin Franz, whose article was published in the December 14th, 2018, issue of the Washington Post. Well, when Rick Lobsher was 6 years old, he rode a streetcar to the circus. The San Francisco native is pretty sure he saw the lions and tigers and all that comes with it, but he wasn't left with much of an impression. "I don't remember the circus," he says 6 decades later, "but I remember the streetcar ride." So started a lifelong fascination with San Francisco streetcars that eventually led to Lobsher playing a key role in the creation of a vintage trolley line through the heart of the city, allowing visitors and commuters alike to ride the rails just as they did a century ago. While perhaps not as recognizable as the city's famed cable cars, the F-Line of the San Francisco Municipal Transportation Agency, also known as MUNI, offers a unique way to take in the sights. Every day, up to 24 vintage streetcars, many built before World War II, carry people from the Castro District to Fisherman's Wharf. San Francisco's past isn't just frozen in an old picture or sitting in a museum, says Ed Rieskin, the transportation agency's director of transportation. You can actually get on and ride these streetcars from another era. Rieskin says that MUNI is unique because it has two vintage types of transit integrated into its otherwise modern system. The famous cable cars date from 1873 and were designed to climb the city's steep hills by connecting to a cable that moves beneath the street. The 1906 earthquake destroyed many of the city's cable car lines, and most were replaced with more modern streetcars, which received their power from an overhead wire. As did in many cities, the streetcar spurred a huge amount of development in San Francisco. By the 1930s, 50 trolley lines connected every neighborhood, including four sets of streetcar tracks right up to the middle of Market Street. Streetcars built the urban America that we know today, Lobsher says. The electric streetcar helped stretch the boundaries of our cities. Streetcar ridership across the country began to decline with the advent of the automobile. In the 1950s, dozens of streetcar routes were replaced with buses in San Francisco. In the 1970s, the city began to modernize its rail system and replaced its old streetcars with modern light rail vehicles. It also put its Market Street route beneath the main thoroughfare. In 1982, the last vintage streetcars were put into storage. To mark the end of rail service on Market Street, Muni rolled out one of its oldest streetcars for a final ride. It was that ride that gave Lobsher, then chair of the San Francisco Chamber of Commerce's Transportation Committee, an idea to organize a vintage trolley festival that would offer rides up and down Market Street on weekends. The chamber took the idea to Mayor Dianne Feinstein, who supported it, but cautioned she did not want to see any junk out there. The first festival was an overwhelming success, and it was repeated for 5 years, setting the stage for a permanent vintage trolley line that through the city. And on September 1, 1995, the F-Line opened for service. The F-Line starts at the intersection of 17th and Castro Streets, in the heart of the vibrant Castro District, and heads toward downtown on Market Street. Heading east, the trolleys pass the U.S. Met, and within a few blocks of landmarks such as City Hall, which features the fifth largest dome in the world, and Union Square. Near the intersection of Market and New Montgomery Streets, the F-Line passes in front of the Palace Hotel, where President Warren G. Harding died in 1923. After skirting the Financial District, the F-Line rounds a curve toward the small San Francisco Railway Museum run by Market Street Railway, a nonprofit organization that advocates for and supports historical transit in the city. Next stop is the Ferry Building, which completed on the city's waterfront in 1898 and is known for its clock tower that reaches 240 feet into the air. From here, the F-Line follows the waterfront all the way to Fisherman's Wharf, a popular tourist attraction. Along the way, passengers can take in views of the bay and Coy Tower, a concrete edifice dedicated to firefighters who perished in some of the city's worst blazes. While the more modern light rail vehicles in Muni's fleet may offer a smoother and quieter ride, the experience of riding one of the vintage cars is much more memorable. Instead of cold plastic seats, the vintage cars have wooden benches, and the only air conditioning is an open window. While Muni has upgraded the cars with amenities such as GPS and backup cameras, all standard on more modern streetcars, you would be hard-pressed to find anyone else from the 21st century when you board. Emma Gonzalez has been at Muni for 20 years and has been working on the vintage streetcars since 2008. She says it's hard not to fall in love with the old cars, which come in a variety of shapes, sizes, and colors. I feel like a movie star operating the old streetcars, she says. People come from all over the world to ride them. Her favorite streetcar is number 578, affectionately called the Dinky. The car was built in 1896 and looks nearly identical to the hill-climbing cable cars. In total, Muni has more than 50 historical streetcars, many from across the United States, but others hail from England, Italy, and Australia. The bulk of the fleet is made up of President's Conference Committee streetcars, or PCCs, streamlined cars that date from the 1930s. More than 4,500 PCCs were built and used in 33 cities. While some of the PCCs are painted in Muni's vintage green and cream livery, most are painted in tribute to different cities that used PCCs, including Washington, Boston, Chicago, and Philadelphia. And as Lobsher says, it's a riot of color, patterns, and designs representing all of the different transit agencies. And that brings us to the end of the line, or the journey, I should say, here on Armchair Traveler. Hope you've enjoyed your traveling today and that you'll be listening next time. I'm Mike Edwards, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of the program intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast readily available as a podcast of the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Comments and questions may be directed to 919-832-5138. Bye-bye.